Live from KTOO in Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea with this news. More than a week after Alaska lawmakers started a session in two different cities, the split is over. Governor Mike Dunleavy announced this afternoon that the location of the second special session has been changed from Wasilla to Juneau. And Dunleavy added the capital budget to the agenda, effective today. Dunleavy spokesman Matt Shuckero says Dunleavy is allowing legislative work to advance.
The governor has said that we have to find a way to move forward, and certainly meeting in two locations isn't going to allow that to happen.
Legislative leaders thanked Dunleavy for the changes. Senate President Kathy Geisel, an Anchorage Republican, says the changes followed a series of meetings the governor has held with the four caucus leaders.
We were very thankful that we could find alignment on the subject of location and the priority of the capital budget.
Lawmakers have expressed concern that the state could lose up to $1 billion in federal funding if the state doesn't fund its share of the capital budget by July 31st. While the legislature passed the capital budget last month, lawmakers couldn't agree on how to fund it. Dunleavy called the special session in Wasilla, but majorities of both chambers met in Juneau. Dueling lawsuits have been filed seeking to invalidate each location. Anchorage Republicans Senator Mia Costello and Representative Lance Pruitt asked Dunleavy to add the capital budget to the call. Pruitt says the governor showed leadership with the new proclamation.
And the governor said, you know, I am going to do everything I can to bring people together so that we can have these conversations.
House Speaker Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham independent, said in a statement that the announcement is a significant step to ending the political turmoil disrupting Alaskans' lives. Lawmakers are expected to arrive in Juneau on Thursday, the 11th day of the 30-day special session. The Alaska chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union is suing Governor Mike Dunleavy over what it says is an unconstitutional and retaliatory move against the state's court system. The group says a veto by the governor last month threatens the separation of powers between the three branches of government. The lawsuit, filed today in state superior court, seeks to restore about $335,000 to the Alaska court system that were among Dunleavy's 182 line item vetoes. The ACLU's Joshua Decker says the lawsuit seeks to reverse the funding cut and declare the action illegal under state law.
The governor's action is so brazen and so unprecedented, all of our previous governors knew not to play politics with our judges, and so that's why we're suing today.
According to the ACLU, this is the first case in Alaska challenging the constitutionality of a veto directed at another branch of government. Dunleavy said he vetoed the court system funding because state Supreme Court has ruled that Medicaid funds can be used to pay for abortions. He said that since both the legislative and executive branches are opposed to public money going toward terminating pregnancies, the annual cost for elective abortions should be borne by the one branch upholding the policy. Decker says that amounts to retaliation and infringes on an independent judiciary.
The governor cannot impermissibly interfere with the functions of another co-equal branch, and we also expect this case to make clear that a governor may not use the veto power to reappropriate money from one legislative appropriated function to another legislatively appropriated function.
Decker says even if the cut to the court system is overturned by legislators along with the other vetoed items, the ACLU is still likely to ask for a ruling on the matter. A spokesperson for the governor's office pointed to broad authority for Alaska's executive branch to issue budget vetoes, but says the office does not comment on pending litigation. For the second day in a row yesterday, members of the House Finance Committee took public testimony on HB 2001, this time at the Legislative Information Office in Wasilla. The proposal would restore funding for the governor's line item budget vetoes, reducing the permanent fund dividend to do so. Though Wasilla and the Mat-Su Borough are strongholds of support for the governor, a majority of those who testified told lawmakers they support efforts to reverse the vetoes, even if it means a lower PFD. Many speakers represented social service providers and public programs in the valley that will be harmed by the cuts. Mark Lackey directs an early learning education program that administers Head Start in the borough in Eagle River. He says he's had to call employees, low-income families, and foster parents to tell them that without a change in the budget situation, sites serving their children will have to close.
I called these people to let them know there wasn't a resolution yet, but if there was and no funding was available, that school would not open. Their center would not open.
Testimony on both sides was at times emotional. While some people made legal and economic arguments to back up their perspectives on what lawmakers ought to do, several people were on the verge of tears describing the personal toll cuts to services or the PFD will mean to them. Close to half of the people who spoke said they support the governor, his efforts to reduce the size of government, and pay a $3,000 PFD. One of them was John Schlanger.
There's people out there struggling each and every day, like me. I make below the poverty level.
Schlanger said a $3,000 PFD would help him care for a disabled family member. The Finance Committee is taking testimony today in Fairbanks until 7 p.m. Across the state, social service providers are already feeling the impact of Governor Mike Dunleavy's budget vetoes. In Juneau, the local homeless shelter and soup kitchen is reckoning with an almost 25% reduction to its already shoestring budget. KTOO's Adeline Baxter has more.
Outside the Glory Hall homeless shelter in downtown Juneau, cruise ship passengers shop for souvenirs along South Franklin Street. Inside, 30 patrons quietly line up for breakfast. On the menu this morning are scrambled eggs and pancakes with a homemade berry glaze. There's no money for syrup.
Our shopping list has shrunk because of this, so it's just stuff.
That's Marty Fred, facility coordinator and head chef. He's learned how to get creative with meal planning over the years, using wild game and fish he harvests himself or food donated to the shelter. He also uses produce from a rooftop garden maintained by staff and patrons. But thrifty solutions can't make up for the fact that the Glory Hall relies on state funding to provide services like meals and beds for up to 40 people. The most recent cuts mean the shelter will have to reduce its hours. The building will close from 7 a.m. to 2 p.m., likely starting next month. That means no breakfast and no lunch.
I mean, I can take loss of hours, but loss of food and the ability to provide for a lot of the people here is just going to be devastating.
Peter Church is eating breakfast at the Glory Hall. This is his first time being homeless. He says the reduced hours will impact nearby businesses because people like him won't have anywhere else to go during the day when the Glory Hall is closed.
There's times where I don't get up to go eat, you know, and I have no place to stay, so I wander around town. You know, I try to stay out of downtown area to, you know, keep the shops, the business owners, you know, happy.
Church relies on occasional meals at the shelter to supplement food stamps.
I guess it's time to go and start putting up some fish and smoking fish. You know, that's the only thing I can do.
The Glory Hall is looking into ways to bring in additional revenue. For years, it's flirted with the idea of moving to a new location. The board of directors is trying to raise $300,000 by September 1st for a down payment on a new property in the Mendenhall Valley. The goal would be to build a new shelter there with better facilities and then either rent or sell the building on Franklin Street. In Juneau, I'm Adeline Baxter.
Moody's Investors Service has downgraded the credit rating for the University of Alaska. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports the lower rating means it will be more difficult for the university to borrow money for various projects.
The university's previous rating of A1 has been dropped three notches to Baa1. In a report from Moody's, the group cited the unprecedented 41% cut in state support for the university from Governor Mike Dunleavy's line item vetoes, the state legislature's failure to override Dunleavy's vetoes, and the university's Board of Regents putting off a vote of financial exigency as reasons for the downgrade. Diane Villacava is a higher education analyst with Moody's. She says the university has unique challenges that make it difficult to offset the budget cuts.
Given the uniqueness of Alaska and University of Alaska's market position and the student population base, it would be very difficult to grow, particularly within 1 year, the tuition revenues to be able to adequately offset that funding cut.
A press release from the university said that the downgrade now makes the University of Alaska the second lowest rated flagship university in the country. Susan Fitzgerald with Moody's says that even though there has never been as drastic a drop in rating for a university in the past, the University of Alaska is still viewed as investment grade.
We're not anticipating that the university is going to default on its debt. We are just highlighting that the credit risk is magnified as they adjust to very material budget reductions.
The Baa1 rating is three levels above non-investment grade. In a statement, UA President Jim Johnson said that declaring financial exigency won't affect the current rating, but could change the university's outlook with Moody's in the future. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
And finally, a tiny Alaska Native village is adopting an emerging technology to transform the power of a local river into a renewable energy source. Village Council in Igigig is the first tribal entity in the nation licensed by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to harness river water that's not connected to a dam. An underwater generator will be installed in coming days in the Quijack River, part of a salmon-rich system that also provides subsistence food for the community of 70. Officials with Ocean Renewable Power Company, which is based in Portland, Maine, say a trial river run of the RivGen power system gives them confidence the system will not harm adult fish. Igigig Village Council President Alexana Salmon says the generator is expected to greatly reduce reliance on costly diesel fuel. Quick look at weather tonight. Showers likely mainly after 10 p.m. Thursday, scattered showers mainly after 1 p.m. Cloudy with a high near 61. That's it for the KTO News Update for Wednesday, July 17th, 2019. I'm Jeremy Shea.